History, my friend, recalls many gentle ironies. Not the least of these was a decision made by the Board of Censorship of Tsar Alexander II to permit the sale and distribution in Russia of a new economic treatise by one Dr. Karl Heinrich Marx on the seemingly plausible grounds, and I quote, that though this volume shows undeniable socialist tendencies, it is nevertheless not written in a popular vein and will not appeal to the general public. Well, the Board of Censorship was right to this extent. Das Kapital is fact-weighted, full of closely drawn logical analysis, of that type of volume which is usually read by 20 scholars besides the author who share with the author a particular field of competence. But history has its own form of logic. And 50 years, almost on the anniversary date of the permission by this Board of Censorship to distribute Das Kapital in Russia, the masses of Russia rose against their Tsarist overlords, and using Das Kapital as guide and as goad and as gospel, established a socialist republic in the name of the author of this volume. No other book in recent history has had the immediacy of impact of this particular economic treatise. Since its first publication in the year 1867, more copies of Das Kapital have been printed than any other book save our Bible. We have to go back some 1,300 years in history to find a book, the Quran, and a man, Muhammad, whose impact upon world history was as decisive and as immediate as that of Karl Marx and of Das Kapital. In his lifetime, Muhammad preached to tens and twenties of peoples in the small Arabian townlets of Mecca and Medina. Yet within three quarters of a century from the date of his death, Islam, his new religion, was the accepted faith of countries as separate as Spain and Indochina, and it was the dominant religious belief of half the civilized world. Now, Karl Marx, in his whole lifetime, never spoke to an audience as large as this one here this morning. When Das Kapital was first published, it sold less than 1,000 copies. When Karl Marx died in the year 1883 in London, where he had lived for a quarter of a century, his passing was so little noted that no obituary notice appeared in any of the important daily London newspapers. And yet within three quarters of a century of his death, two of the most populous and powerful states of our world, and individuals numbering into the tens of millions, accept his teachings as official doctrine, as scripture, gospel. Now Marx believed himself to be, above all else, a scientist and a scholar, an economic historian, an economic analyst, and a philosopher. He disliked religion, he mistrusted inspiration, he respected only hard logic and cold fact. And yet I would submit that we can understand the impact of Karl Marx only if we conceive his teachings in religious terms, and only if we conceive of his mission as that of a prophet, of a man who brought to the world a new gospel, a new message of salvation, of glad tidings. Now Marx himself would, of course, have bristled in indignation, have sat down and written one of his usual vitriolic diatribes if he had heard me make this comparison. And yet, though Das Kapital is a brilliant scholarly book, and though 9/10 of its pages are consumed with detailed research and analysis into the economic conditions of life in Marx's day and into the facts which were available in his day as to the history of mankind, I submit to you that most people have never read these pages and would have understood them little had they read them. And that what people understood of Karl Marx was largely this, that he had established as an iron law of history that destiny stood with the proletariat, with the lower dispossessed, underprivileged classes. For Marx believed that history was not a matter of chance. Rather, it followed certain inexorable laws, that there was always in history a series of class wars between the haves and the have-nots. And according to Marx, mankind had now come to that position where the one remaining great group of have-nots were the laboring classes. And their misery was such that they would soon band together. Their misery was such that it would break their bands and the chains which bound them to their misery, and they would rise against their capitalist overlords and revolt and establish a new form of government in which each man would be repaid according to his needs, not made to slave for the benefit of another. The lower classes found in Marx a prophet who preached the glad tidings of their destiny, a glorious destiny, a destiny for which they longed and prayed and hoped. And we need only rehearse briefly the economic conditions of European life in the 19th century to realize why men needed to be dazzled by this hope and to believe in this gospel. England was the most advanced industrial state of Europe in the middle of the 19th century. England had a long and proud tradition of culture, learning, religion. And yet in England, this proud, modern England, children were sent into the mines and into the factories at 6 and 7 years of age. They worked from 12 to 14 hours a day, 7 days of the week. In Manchester, for which we have statistics, the average lifespan of the businessman and of his family was 38 years. The average lifespan of a member of the laboring classes was less than 17 years. The employer had every right to bargain with his employees, but the employees had no right to bargain collectively with their employers. There were no safety and health regulations, no sanitary housing, wages were minimal, child labor was not abolished. There was a degree of cupidity and venality, of exploitation, which it defies description to those of us who live in the 20th century. And we can project from England to the continent where working conditions were compounded in their misfortune. For on the continent there was not only an exploited laboring class, but there was a serf class bound by feudal ties to the land, forced by law to work on land of a feudal overlord to his profit and not to their own. Serfs who had no education, no hope, no medical care, substandard housing, who could look forward only to a life of want and of misery and of early death. Now, is it any wonder that the millions took to this gospel? That they found that in this iron law of history which Marx had established for them, they found this to be heady wine. The hope which they needed to hang on to, the promise of a glorious future. And they took Marx as their prophet, and with him they sought to march into this future. Now, Marx's doctrines are much more subtle, much more sophisticated, much more scholarly than I have outlined. Marx himself was preeminently a man of ideas and of books. From adolescence to old age, Marx spent from 12 to 16 hours a day, every day of the week, at his desk, reading and researching and writing. The vastness of his erudition is beyond question, and Marx was able very often to confound someone who sought to debate with him in a better cause, simply because he knew more of the law, more of economics, more of political theory, more of history, and even more of literature than the man who was debating with him. And many of the young intellectuals of Europe who were heart sick and soul sick at the misery which they saw about him, about them, took to Marx's teachings because of its scholarship, because of its originality, because many of the ideas which he put forth were apt and were cogent, because he offered them the only key to a rectifying of the wrongs which they sensed and which they saw. And these intellectuals acted as his disciples, were the messengers of this gospel, reduced it, simplified it, brought it to the masses, and found for Marx that mass appeal which he might not otherwise have had. But I insist upon this, that we can understand Marx's popularity only and largely in religious terms, that his popularity is in inverse proportion to the misery of the masses of Europe. And indeed, we can see this in retrospect by comparing the march of communism in Eastern Europe and in our own country. Here, where the people and the government came early to grips with the problems of exploited labor, here where we abolished child labor, where we established health and welfare standards, where we insisted upon opening the voting records so that all men, regardless of property qualifications, could cast their ballot, here where we established a free public school system, here Marxism made comparatively little inroads. For here men did not need to be dazzled by this hope. Here they could sit and they could read and they could debate and they could see some of the omissions, some of the discrepancies, some of the vagaries of Marx's doctrine. And they could balance out in their minds the question whether or not Marx's promise of revolution, a force, naked, brutal force, was such a one as they wanted to take to themselves, or rather if they did not enjoy here, in reality, the very promises which Marx held for them after this bloodbath. And indeed, Marxism has retained largely the coloration of a religious institution, even to our day. It maintains its board of missionaries who seek to make converts about the world. Every political decision has to be justified by recourse to some scriptural verse, and the party is as ingenious as any historical church in quoting scripture to suit its own purposes. But those who oppose the particular policy of the party are not a loyal opposition, as are the out-of-power parties in our country, but rather heretics. Deviationists, to use the Marxian terms. Deviationists from what? If not from some holy scripture, if not from Das Kapital. And finally, there are zealots in the Communist Party, as there were zealots who preached holy war in Islam and zealots who preached crusade and the Inquisition in Catholic Christianity, who become impatient with the progress of communism in its conversion, its world mission, and who seek to impose by force this mission upon the rest of the world. So to return to the concept of historical irony with which we began, this skeptic, this disbeliever, becomes historically one of the great prophets of modern times, the patron saint of a new religion, and a more unlikely prophet the world has never known. Karl Marx was a cold, intellectually arrogant, hate-ridden man. He was convinced of the truth of his own mission, but I suspect that he had very little instinctive sympathy for the working classes who thronged in time to his banner. Karl Marx was born in Trier, Germany, the year 1818. His father was a not too well-to-do lawyer, who 2 years before Marx's birth had converted to the official Lutheran Church. His conversion had been one of convenience, not of conviction. The elder Marx believed in the law, in science, and in the destiny of Germany, but certainly not in God. He was convinced and confirmed agnostic, for whom Judaism had long ceased to have any meaning and whose Jewishness was a bar to advancement in his legal profession. As far as Judaism was concerned, young Marx In his home, heard only a shamefaced silence. And on the streets, the jeers and taunts of schoolmates and later of disputants and debaters who knew full well the motives of his family's conversion. There is nothing in Karl Marx which reflects any understanding of Judaism or any pride in being Jewish. Quite the contrary. Marx is abysmally ignorant of our faith and is riddled with hate and frustration at his being numbered among our people. And I insist upon this because there are some among us who insist that simply because of Marx's fame, he is one of us. And there are others not so friendly to our people who, following discredited racial doctrines, pawn Marx off upon us, and thus say that we are the progenitors of the communist faith. Let me quote to you briefly some of the things which Marx himself feels about Judaism. What was the essential foundation, he writes, of the Jewish religion? Practical needs, egotism. Money is the zealous one God of Israel, besides which no other God may stand. Money degrades all the gods of mankind and turns them into commodities. Money is the universal and self-constituted value set upon all things. It has therefore robbed the whole world of both nature and man of its original value. Money is the essence of man's life and work, which have become alienated from him. This alien monster rules him, and he worships it. What is stated as theory in Jewish religion, namely contempt for theory, art, history, and man as an end in himself, is an actual and conscious point of view held to be virtuous by the man of money. Even the relation between the sexes, between man and woman, becomes an object of commerce. The woman in Jewish life is auctioned off. The law of the Jew, lacking all solid foundation, is only a religious caricature of morality and of law in general. But it provides the formal rights in which the world of property clothes its transactions. Marx indicted an essay when he was in his 20s entitled A World Without Jews, and I'm certain that such a world would have suited him. And if we sometimes wonder at the acts of anti-Semitism which we hear about in the Soviet Union, we must remember that not only is there in Russia a century-long tradition of Slavic hatred of the Jew, but there is also the wide publication and dissemination of these views of the prophet and founder of modern communism. And combined together, they make for heady wine. Now, the young Marx's academic record was an excellent one. He was a voracious reader. He had a keen, logical, perceptive mind. He proposed originally to study law, as had his father. But at the university in Berlin, he was influenced by the philosophy of one George Wilhelm Hegel. He determined to become a philosopher by vocation, academician in life. Indeed, he did receive his doctorate of philosophy from the University of Jena. But Germany during Marx's youth was riddled by censorship and ruled by reactionaries and ripe for revolution. And the university students were the seedbed, the ferment of this discontent. And Marx, like so many of his confraternity, became a political radical. His political radicalism closed the doors to him of an academic career. He soon found himself in Paris, which was then the center of much of the discontent and the disgruntlement of the angry young men of Europe. Here, hundreds of Marx's contemporaries were busily indicting vitriolic pamphlets of denunciation against the cruelties and injustices of the Kaiser's rule and the Tsar's rule and all the other rulers of Europe, and busily arguing in the cafes of Paris as to what particular philosophic and political scheme they would adopt once revolution brought them to power. But Marx came to this environment in the year 1843, 5 years before revolution broke out in France and in Germany. But Marx had a more scholarly bent of mind. He did not rush into the fray, rather he sat back and he studied. And he sought to understand why political institutions had developed as they had, why economic conditions were as they were. And for 2 years, he spent his time and his energies busily reading, devouring every text of political science, of economic theory, of social theory, of philosophy, which was available to him. And gradually his philosophic and political and economic views began to take shape. And Marx began to feel that history is not a matter of chance, wars and of kings and of conquests, but rather history reveals a definite pattern of growth and development. And this pattern is largely one which is dependent upon and catalyzed by the economic means of production in the society. There is always a class war in any age between those in control and those out of power, between the haves and the have-nots. Those who are in power model the law, model the political institutions, model even the religious institutions to preserve their special privileges. Those out of power model a new philosophic set of principles, a new set of political outlooks and institutions, a new concept, new ideals to force them into power. In the Middle Ages, the political system was feudalism. Wealth depended upon ownership of the land. The church consecrated the ties that bound the serf to the land and the knave to his master. But gradually, life changed. The Industrial Revolution came about. Wealth was centered now not only on the land, but in the factory, in commerce, and in business. And the middle class began to dispute with the aristocracy for power. And out of this dispute, Marx said, came the capitalistic system which Europe enjoyed in his day. And now the center of the class war shifts. Now the middle class and the aristocracy share the position of the haves, and the lower classes, the proletariat, the workers, are the have-nots. But according to Marx's analysis, capitalism cannot long survive. For capitalism means, according to Marx, that wealth will flow more and more into the hands of fewer and fewer people. That more and more of even the middle class will be forced into penury, into misery. And gradually the pressures of misery will build up to such an extent that there will be an eruption, a breakthrough, a revolution. And once this revolution has taken place, the laboring classes will be in control of the government and control of the economics means of production, and they will mold a new series of institutions, church, cultural, political, which will establish the rights of all men to a free share of the earth's bounty and prosperity, and which regulate life for the good of all. Now, Marx's first publication, which attracted worldwide notice, in which he set down these principles, was put out in the year 1847, 1848, just as the great revolutions in Germany and in France were about to break forth. A group of exiled German workers, labor organizers, rabble-rousers, had banded together out in their exile to form what was known as the League of the Just. They had been attracted by Marx's views as he had published them here and there in Paris. And they asked Marx, in collaboration with a younger disciple, Friedrich Engels, to publish a manifesto for them, a statement of belief, a statement which would set forth the principles for which they were fighting, the purposes of life and of political action as they saw it, and which would give the broad sweep of destiny to the worker, his vision of the future. In 1847, the League of the Just changed its name to the Communist League. And Marx and Engels in 1848 published for this Communist League their manifesto, the Communist Manifesto. And this manifesto has been the key text for all communist movements since that day. In it, Marx sets forth the immediate goals of the laboring classes and their ultimate goals. Their immediate goals are to destroy property, to establish a free public school education, to establish minimum wage and maximum hour laws, to abolish child labor, to establish a gradated income tax, to establish prohibitive death duties, to see to it that the kind of society evolves in which the laborer will get what is his due. And their ultimate goal, the overthrow of the capitalist class, the establishment of the dictatorship of the proletariat, which in its turn will wither away, and a new democratic form of socialism will be established, where every man will have his say and his vote and his share of Earth's bounty. When the revolution of 1848 broke out, Marx plunged into its activities, but he was soon disappointed. For this was a revolution in Marx's terms of the middle class, not of the worker. And within a year, he was forced out again, forced into exile, now to London, where, in penury and poverty, he lived out his days, little known, but prolifically writing and working, researching and publishing. He devoted 15 years of his life to the publication, the writing of Das Kapital, the first volume of which appeared in his lifetime, the second and third volumes of which were published by his lifelong cohort Engels after his death, and the fourth volume of which was left in the form of brief notes which have only recently been published. They are a mighty indictment of the capitalist system. They are a mighty defense of Marx's economic philosophy and his economic view of history. Now, what shall we say of Marx's position in history? How shall we assess his contribution or lack of it to our world? First of all, we must say that as a social critic, Marx did point to inexcusable crimes against humanity. Child labor, inadequate housing, inadequate wages, inadequate health standards, the inability of the employer to employee to collectively bargain with the employer. Marx lived in the days of unrestrained capitalism, of rugged individualism, and he was right in his denunciation of its evils and of its excesses. And the rightness of his views can be seen in the degree to which we in our own country have developed limitations and safeguards on this kind of unrestrained capitalism, where we have insisted that there is a primary social responsibility, and only when the rights of all have been safeguarded has a man the permission to seek as much of income and prosperity as he can find. What of Marx the scholar? Marx, the scholar, was right in that he insisted that almost all the institutions of man, our law, our culture, our school systems, our churches, reflect a great deal of the economic conditions of life at a particular moment. Now, few would agree with his wholly deterministic view of the development of these institutions. But no self-respecting scholar would today attempt a history of our world, the history of the growth of even of the ideas of our world, without explaining how technology and science and industry and economics have affected the changing pattern of world history and world ideas. And it was Marx who first developed in extenso this concept of history. But as a prophet, Marx was a false prophet. Marx was wrong in many, many ways. It was wrong that if the proletariat came to power, they would quickly divest themselves of this power. He was wrong that when he held that the dictatorship of the proletariat would become a form of vague, free, democratic socialism. Power corrupts. And as we have seen in the Russian state, far from loosening their holds upon the masses who revolted in the name of Marx, the Communist Party has intensified its control, intensified its censorship, intensified its dictatorship as time has gone on. Indeed, the Russian Revolution itself is a disproof of Marxist theories. Marx believed that the revolution would come in the West, in England or in France or in Germany, where industrialization had the chance to develop for a much longer time than in Russia. The Russian Revolution, in a sense, is a movement from feudalism to communism without the intermediate step of capitalism, which Marx conceived to be necessary. For Marx conceived that under the capitalistic system, the condition of the worker must inevitably become worse and worse. He had no rights, he had no power, he had no privilege. He could be exploited for the benefit of those who control the tools of production. And we have only to look around ourselves to realize that this is not necessarily the case. But certainly there has been no economy in the history of the world in which the privileges and the wages and the rights of the worker have been as high as in our own nation. Why was Marx wrong? Here we come to the final irony of this story. Marx was wrong because he failed to understand, because he closed his mind to an aspect of life which this pulpit in our tradition teaches. Marx saw only one aspect of man, the economic man, one instinct in man, the acquisitive instinct. Marx was determined that all that was spiritual, all that was moralistic, all that we would call good and saintly, was simply a form of posing and of pretense. That religion was no more than a propaganda agency for the economic powers then at play. Had Marx's assessment of human psychology been correct, England and France and our own country would not have developed the restrained forms of capitalism, the high standard of living for all of our peoples, the high degree of social legislation which we have effected. Indeed, we have put into practice in our own nation most of the very ideas which Marx set forth as necessities in his Communist Manifesto. And we have established these rights of the worker without losing our freedom by granting him freedom, without imposing upon ourselves a dictatorship, and without plunging our country into a bloodbath and a revolution. Why so? Because man is, as our Jewish tradition tells us, composed of two elements. One is selfish, but one is saintly. One side of man is greedy, but one side of man is godly. One side of man has only the instinct to aggrandize, to take unto himself. But the heart of man, the soul of the man, the mind of man is capable of restraining himself, of planning for the future of all men, of seeing that ultimately his welfare is tied up with the welfare of all and cannot be separated from that well-being. So Marx, in essence, has driven us to recognize the truth of the very doctrines he contemned. The truth that if we do not establish justice in the gates, if we do not work to relieve oppression, to establish the equality of opportunity of all, if we do not work to establish what Amos was speaking about in the portion that was read to you this morning, then his theories, his revolution will come about. But if we work as our prophets bid us work, there is the capacity in man to be divine, to establish a peaceful and just order of society, to gradually evolve a society which will redound to the well-being of all. And we will not need to be dazzled by vague promises, promises which are never fulfilled. Marx died. Friedrich Engels pronounced the eulogy over his bier. In this eulogy, he compared the contribution of Marx to that of Charles Darwin. Both men, he said, had given to the world a radical new truth, a new idea. Now, to the few pitiable exiles, the family of Marx standing by the side of this grave, such a comparison must have seemed grand indeed. But history has told us that the influence of this man was as deed as great, if not far greater, than that of the eminent biologist whom we discussed 2 weeks ago. Marx brought to the laboring classes one essential truth: their right to a fair share of the earth's prosperity and bounty. They forced upon those in the middle and upper classes a realization that they were going to have to, one way or another, accede to these demands, either gradually, thoughtfully, as we have in our own nation, or by force, with a gun to their heads, as in Russia and China and elsewhere. And our job is not over, my friends. Marx's challenge to us has not been completely dissipated. There are still in our own country segments of people to whom this prophecy might dazzle. And there are certainly abroad in the world, especially in the underdeveloped parts of the world, millions upon millions of people who have not the most elemental rights. And if we wish to contain and to restrict this gospel of revolution, then you and I must see to it that in every way that it is possible for us to do, we extend opportunity, we extend promise, we extend rights, we extend protective legislation to the oppressed and to the underprivileged, lest they be infected with the incubus of this prophecy. And marching with Marx, take a road which will not lead them to the end that they desire, but will lead them into the hands of a few in control of the organs of government who will exploit them as mercilessly as did any czar of old. So Marx paradoxically has led us back to an affirmation of the truths of our own faith, a realization of the meaningfulness of the Hebrew psychology, realization of the imperative of biblical prophecy.